Sure is good to see you all this evening. We've had some challenges in terms of some blood work and appointments and some unforeseen things that we've gone through, and we were hoping that somehow we could jump through all those hoops and still keep our commitment here, and we're thankful that has worked out. In the interest of full disclosure, I don't use a cane ordinarily. That's just one of those little hiccups, too, that has just come along that hopefully will be resolved soon. But I don't want you thinking I'm old, because that's just not the case at all. But, you know, I guess it's good for things like that to happen occasionally. It does tend to keep one humble. So it's great to see all of you. I appreciate so much the invitation. And my wife, Linda, is with me. She goes with me everywhere. And I'm so thankful to God for her. The next month makes 50 years that we have been married, and I'm thankful to God for that. But we're here tonight to begin our first lesson in terms of a visualized survey of the Bible. I can tell you that I used to call this the history and geography of the Bible. I started doing this series, which, of course, has been an ongoing work and very different now than then, but back in 1993. That's how long I've been doing this in gospel meetings. And Sewell Hall had asked that I come up at Upper Manhattan when he was there and do this series there. And he said, Leon, he said, what you're doing when you cover the biblical material, he said, you are teaching the Bible. You are surveying the Bible with visuals. He said, a lot of people think they don't like history and geography. He said, you ought to call it a visualized survey of the Bible. And I have to do what Sewell Hall says. So there you have it. But that's what we're doing. We're telling the story of redemption from Genesis to Revelation. And it's a privilege to do that. I thank you for your interest. And we begin in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1. Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim ve'et ha'aretz. In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was waste and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God brooded upon the face of the water. And God said, light be. And light was. And there was evening and there was morning. Yom Echad, day one. And in 6 days God made the heavens and earth and all things that are therein. Last of all on day six making man. And Genesis 1 and verse 31, he looked at all that he had made, and behold, it was tov me'od. It was very good. God placed Adam and Eve in the beautiful Garden of Eden. Of course, we don't know exactly where that was, but somewhere in the area of Mesopotamia. And we don't know how long went by until Satan entered the garden and tempted Eve first to sin. And she gave the forbidden fruit to Adam, and he sinned. And so sin entered the world. God could have waited, and I say this only theoretically, because that's not what happened, but he could have waited centuries to give any ray of hope as far as just a case could be made for that. That could have been what he did, but that's not what he did. Our God is merciful. Though we have sinned, he has mercy and pardon. And so when sin first entered the world, we have actually the first promise of redemption that goes with that. This is a very key passage, because the rest of the Old Testament is going to be the unfolding and developing of this promise, where God said, actually speaking to Satan, I will put enmity between you and the woman, between her seed and your seed. You shall bruise his head, and he shall bruise your heel. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. And so this is Hebrew poetry. To bruise the head of a serpent means to take away its power, to give it a death blow. And yet in the process of that, this seed of woman would bruise his heel. And the death by crucifixion was one of the most excruciating deaths that man has ever invented on purpose. It was intended to be that way. And there's no way in the world you can compare crucifixion to bruising your heel, except for the fact that when Jesus was crucified, death could not keep its prey, Jesus my Savior. He tore the bars away, Jesus my Lord. On the third day, he, as Romans 1 and verse 4 says, he was declared to be the Son of God with power by the resurrection from the dead. And so for Jesus, as painful as it was, death was like the bruising of a heel. It's painful, but you get over it in a short time. Well, all that's a lot in one verse. It'll be the seed of woman, and he's going to give the victory over Satan, who has just tempted them to sin. Well, time goes on. This is a survey, and we pass on down through time. We pass on. Adam and Eve had sons and daughters besides Cain, Abel, and Seth. Genesis 5 mentions in verse 4 that he had other sons and daughters. In Genesis 6 and verse 8, Genesis 6, verse 5. By that point in time, it says, every imagination of the thought of man's heart was only evil continually. And this is when God determined to destroy all the earth, the population, with a great flood. But in verse 8, the Bible says Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. And so, as Hebrews 11 will look back, he built an ark to the saving of his house. Or as 1 Peter 3 will look back and say, eight souls were saved by water. Noah and his wife, Ham, Shem, and Japheth, and their wives. And so God renewed his covenant with Noah. And as a matter of fact, it's going to be through Shem that the promise will continue. But speaking of the flood, I did want to mention to you how that the ark came to rest in the mountains of Ararat. You see here the word Urartu. If you've got good eyes, it's kind of small print, isn't it? But this is not just one peak. It's a range of mountains. But the highest mountain in that area is known as Mount Ararat. There's the Ararat Range, and this is Mount Ararat right here. I was privileged to be here a few years ago, several years ago now, on a personal study tour for research and photography, and spent a couple of days there. And when we first got there, we were about to go in a little store and get some water and some supplies, and I looked toward Mount Ararat. I said, there's a rainbow. And I mean, we jumped in the car, got away from the electric lines and a place where we could get a good photo. Let me show you one of my most special photos. That's not enhanced or retouched in any way, but I thought, what a wonderful opportunity to see Mount Ararat and to get to see a rainbow, which was God's, the token of his promise that he would never again destroy the earth with a flood. Doesn't say there won't be any more floods, but a global flood to destroy the earth as that flood had been, there would not be another flood like that. And so time goes on. The earth is repopulated. Actually, God had said to spread out, to replenish the earth. But instead of that, they concentrated, at least initially, at Babylon, at Shinar, and they said, let us build a tower that'll reach to heaven. Let's make a name for ourselves. And up until this point in time, men had spoken only one language. God came down and he confounded the languages. So this is where you have the beginning of the various language families, as we would know today. And so they did disperse and go in various places. God is sovereign, and it's better to cooperate with the divine will, but his will be done. And so they were scattered, and so you have the distribution of the nations from Ham, Shem, and Japheth. And as I said, it's going to be through Shem that the messianic promise will continue. In fact, when you come, that's Genesis chapter 10. And when you come to Genesis 11, you're going to find another genealogy right after the Tower of Babel. They said, let us make a name for ourselves. That's their name, Babel, which means confusion. But you have the genealogy from Abraham through, you have the genealogy from Noah through Shem down to Terah, the father of Abraham. So that's what Genesis 11, the latter part, serves to do. It takes us into that, it ushers into us to that patriarchal period. And so Abraham was called from Ur of the Chaldees. There's been a lot of excavation done there, and it was really a highly developed city that Abraham left to go dwell in tents at a place that God was showing. Now, since he was very rich and wealthy, I'm sure Abraham had a good tent. But a tent, when you get through, is still a tent. And he left. He left the comforts of civilization to go to the place that God told him to go. One archaeological discovery that's very helpful for the patriarchal period is known as the Nuzi tablets. And this is one of them, of that set, that I photographed at the Harvard Museum in Boston. And the value here is that it talks about life. This is not biblical, but it talks about life in the time of the patriarchs. For example, it mentioned the practice that if a husband and wife could not have a child of their own, that a willing participant, a woman, would be secured who would agree to bear a child for them, and that child would be their own. In other words, the very kind of thing that Hagar, Sarah suggested, so that Hagar became Abraham's wife, and of course Ishmael was born. Now the point is that didn't help anything. That just, you know, that they were trying to help God, I suppose, but it didn't help anything. It caused problems of its own. But it helps you to see that they didn't just somehow imagine that and it just comes out of the blue. But here's something that was done in frequently in culture. Another thing that's interesting in the Nuzi tablets is the custom that whoever had the household gods, that this was equivalent to having the deeds of ownership for the property. In other words, I think in terms of Rachel, when Jacob and Rachel and Leah and Bilhah and Zilpah, you know, all of his wives, his children, when they left, it includes that little tidbit of information that she took the household gods. And you could think, well, she's just an idolater. She took those that she might worship them, but that's not necessarily true, especially when you consider the conversation when Jacob says, your father hasn't treated me fairly. He's changed my wages 10 times. His countenance has changed, and the Lord has told me to go back to my home country. But he laid that out there before them, and both Leah and Rachel not only were willing, but they said, our father has sold us and our property. In other words, they were actually, that you don't read about that anywhere else, but with that conversation, they don't appreciate the way that matters have been handled. And it very well could be that simply that, as the Nuzi tablets would point out, that proof of ownership for the property, as she thought her dad had not treated them fairly. It's just a suggestion. But those are things, though, that again illustrate the point. We're dealing with real people, real events, real history, real places. But let's get Abraham moved from Ur of the Chaldees. And we don't get him moved all at one time to the land of Canaan. Do you remember that for a while he settles in Haran? And it doesn't say he passed through there. The text says he dwelt there. He dwelt there in Haran, which is upper Mesopotamia, right there. So the text says he dwelt there. So let's take a look at Haran. Do you notice a little tributary there? A little tributary of water that flows into the Euphrates River, right there. And so we'll take you right there. We'll go through the city limit sign. 50 kilometers per hour is your speed limit, by the way. Population, 8,800. But the stream of water, I was just showing you the tributary, that's this right here. And I'll tell you one thing that's not changed since the biblical times is the shepherd with his sheep. This is the kind of thing that was going on in the days of Abraham and continues to this very day. The shepherd with his sheep and some goats mixed in there as well. And I've taken so many photos like this, and I never get tired of seeing that. And when you see a group, if you see the sheep first and you don't see the shepherd, just look around. Just take a moment to look, and you'll spot him. There'll be one or even two shepherds that will be tending to the sheep. And so this is Haran, the houses that were there in the days of Abraham were built according to this pattern. These are beehive-shaped houses. Now these are about 200 years old, but they're built according to the kinds of houses that were there in the days of Abraham. And I will tell you, I've been inside these when it was hot. And I don't know exactly how they work that out, but it's quite comfortable inside. They're able to circulate the air and put some nice throw rugs and actually have it looking pretty nice. I'm not saying I'd want to move there and live there, but it's actually pretty nice. And this woman here had no idea I was going to be showing her photo in Jessup, Georgia. But you might think, well, that's nice. She's kind of cleaning up around there. No, that's her firewood. She'll use that to cook in her oven. Haran was actually a significant town, and there's been a lot of excavation that was done there. And so again, this is where Abraham lived for some time, and I'm pointing that out because when he left here, he leaves family behind here. And this is where Jacob will go to get his wives. Well, actually, he went to get one wife, but he ended up with four. You know, I hate it when that happens. But anyway, you know the story. But that was here. And then before that, this is where Isaac procured Rebekah as well. So Haran is significant from that standpoint. Another thing that is of interest that I want to share with you is we have found there, archaeologists have determined there, the temple of the sun god. And I'll tell you what this illustrates. You remember that when Joshua told the people to choose this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served, which were beyond the river, or the true God. Well, this would be an example that at Haran there was pagan worship, and the fathers, in other words, some of Abraham's family had been idolaters and would have worshipped at such places such as this. And so he's here at Haran. He's arrived there in the last part of Genesis 11. And so as Genesis 12 continues, this is where God gives Abraham those very important promises. He says, I will make of you a great nation, verse 2. And verse 3, and you shall all families of the earth be blessed. Now this is going to be repeated a number of times, and sometimes the wording will be, in your seed shall all families of the earth be blessed. But I point that out because this promise here in verse 3 is actually the same thing as Genesis 3 and verse 15. It's the blessing is going to be through Christ, forgiveness of sins and all spiritual blessings, but that's going to come through Abraham. And so already when you read the Bible, there's been a clear point of emphasis. In Genesis 5, it's Adam through Seth down to Noah. In Genesis 11, it's Noah through Shem down to Abraham. And so Abraham is then given these promises, and they will be repeated to Isaac as well as to Jacob. Now, you're probably thinking, but what about the land promise? That's going to come a couple of verses later. But first, let's get him into the land, because that's the way God did it. He got him into a place that is called Shechem. And Genesis 12 and verse 6 says, he's made his way to that point, to Shechem. And it tells us that the Canaanite was then in the land. In other words, it was a populated land. And it's here in verse 7 that the Lord appeared to Abraham and said, unto thy seed will I give this land. So it's interesting, Abraham's feet are planted. He's standing there in Shechem. when God says, I'm going to give you this land. And so ordinarily it's going to be nation promise, land promise, spiritual blessing promise will be the order. But when first given, he saved the land promise for last because he let Abraham be in the land before he made that promise. And so here we are. It's thrilling to me to be able to go where Abraham went and to see what he saw. So this is Shechem here in the foreground. You see some of the walls. These walls, some of them go back to Canaanite times. A lot of archaeology has been done here at Shechem. And what you're looking at here is Mount Ebal. And we're going to change positions just a little bit. We still see Shechem in the middle. And this is Mount Gerizim. But this is where Abraham was. He was at Shechem. And when now he could, these buildings weren't there. But when he turned around, he's seeing the same land formations. He's seeing the same territory and geography that we can see today. Isn't that special to get to be where Abraham was when God says, unto your seed I will give this land? Now, just a quick point or two about that. Later in the days of the conquest, Israel comes back to this point. 601,730 men of war. Six tribes will be on the Mount of Cursing, Mount Ebal. Six tribes will be on the Mount of Blessing, Mount Gerizim. All the words of the law will be read by the Levites and Joshua, and all the people will say amen. So they're here to take the land, to receive the land, but it's based upon the covenant of their God. They're not just getting land, it's the covenant that all that is based upon. By the way, I mentioned you can still see Canaanite walls. This is one of the gates, the foundational gates of the city, again, that goes back to Canaanite times. So to me, it's thrilling to see those actual places like that. So from here, Abraham is going to journey. We're in Genesis 12, and he's actually in a time of famine, going to make his way all the way down to Egypt, and then he'll go back into the land. And so I don't know what he saw or how long he stayed. If he wanted to see the pyramids, he could see the pyramids. There's a misconception people have. People think that the Israelites were used as slave labor to build the pyramids. That's not true. The pyramids were already there when Israel was there. They were there before Abraham. The pyramids were. What Israel was used for was, the text says, to build storage cities. That's what they did, not the pyramids. But he could have seen that one of the great pyramids here, and the Sphinx of Khafre, and again, that was there if he had had the interest and time to go see that. But he makes his way back to Mamre, to the area of Hebron. It's going to be here that there's a separation that takes place. Lot, his nephew, is going to pitch his tent toward Sodom. And so there's a separation that will take place. And meanwhile, God appears to Abraham here at this point. Now I'm fast-forwarding to Genesis 15, and it is here that he gives what we would call the greater land promise that would go from the river of Egypt, which is not the Nile River. The river of Egypt is a brook right here, the Wadi El Arish. And he's going to give the land from the river of Egypt all the way to the great river, the river Euphrates. So in addition to the land of Canaan, that additional territory was mentioned. Not that Israel would live in all of that, but they would have control over that. That would be realized in the days of David and Solomon. But here Abraham is in Hebron. I wanted to show you a little bit about Hebron. It has great significance today and has had for now basically 4,000 years. And it was here that Abraham would procure a burial place when Sarah died, just again to let you see the area around Hebron. And this right here is the cave of Machpelah. And what you see is a structure built on top of that by Herod the Great, because he wanted to honor the Jews. He wanted to ingratiate himself with them. He wanted them to like him. And the thing about this, unlike the temple that Herod renovated in Jerusalem, which was destroyed in AD 70, this building was never destroyed. But actually the same kind, the exact same kind of masonry that was used in the Tyropian Valley that can still be seen with the western wall, as well as otherwise the structure for the temple, you can still see that here. The cave, of course, the burial place is under there. It's going to be at this point that God is going to tell Abraham, the child of promise has been born. Time's passing on. I've told you we're moving along here. And so Isaac now, a young lad. And God tells him, Abraham, to take him to Mount Moriah and to offer him as a sacrifice. I don't know what thoughts went through Abraham's mind at that point, but I know what he did. The text says that he arose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and made his way to do what God said. I don't even know if he consulted Sarah about that. He immediately went to do what God said. And now we know that God intervened and did not allow him to slay Isaac, but Hebrews 11 verse 19 tells us that in a figure he received him back from the dead. Abraham believed God would raise him from the dead. His faith was such that God cannot lie. And so he was leaving the results to God. He was going to obey God. What is significant about that point where he offered Isaac to that point and was stopped by the hand of God? That's going to be the very place that in 2 Chronicles chapter 3 and verse 1 that Solomon built the temple. It was on Mount Moriah. So Abraham built an altar here, and then Solomon built the altar here for the temple, that very place. So we move along. Then Abraham moves from Hebron down further south. Further south from Hebron, the Ridge Road just goes right on to the south here, all the way down here to Bethlehem. All the way down here to Beersheba. And this is in the Negev. And this is dry most of the time, although I've seen it when there was greenery there. Let you see an aerial shot from up above. I've been able to do aerial photography a couple of times, and that's one that I took of Beersheba looking down. And here we are at ground level at the gate of the city. And here again, the well reminds you that there was water there. And also, this is a tamarisk tree. And it tells us that Abraham planted a tamarisk tree there and called upon the name of the Lord. So that's Beersheba. And at Beersheba, you can look to the south and you can just see how barren that is. Beersheba came to be quite an important city, and a lot of excavation has been done there. But I mentioned a while ago, we were talking about Jacob, and he made his way to Haran, and he met and married his cousin Rachel, and Leah, and Bilhah, and Zilpah. And again, a lot of intrigue is involved in that, but I'm trusting that you know that narrative. So after the 20 years of 7 years, see, Dave Ramsey would never have approved. He bargained to get Rachel on the installment plan, 7 years. Except the deceiver was deceived, and Laban has him marry Leah. And that morning after the wedding night, what is this that you've done? What is this? And he said, well, we forgot to tell you that around these parts it's not customary to marry the younger before the older. And so you fulfill her week. You can marry Leah or marry Rachel and then work 7 more years. So he did that, and 6 years then for wages. So at the end of 20 years, he made his way back to Canaan's land. And he's going to make his way to Succoth, and he's going to dwell there for a bit and then continue. There is Succoth. Here is Penuel. Here is the Jabbok River. Now, all this today is in Jordan. But I wanted to show you where we're talking about here. I was thrilled just a few years ago to have the occasion to see the Jabbok River. And this, of course, is a river that will flow on into the Jordan. But it's somewhere along in here that he wrestled with the angel of the Lord. And the text mentions his crossing the Jabbok and preparing to meet Esau, which turned out fine, showing you the road he would have taken onto Shechem. In fact, the Wadi al-Farain, this would have been the route that he would have taken. So let's just go up that and up that. And here's a satellite photo, again, getting us there all the way here to Shechem. And this is where Dinah, his daughter, was defiled. And that, of course, was a bad thing. But what Levi and Simeon did was also a bad thing. Okay. Now, by the way, I should tell you this early on. We're covering a lot of passages and points, and I don't want to overwhelm you. But on the other hand, I don't want to underwhelm you. I just want to whelm you. So that's what I'm seeking to do. So we pause and take our breath here, and now we're going to see Jacob is in the land with his sons, and he sends Joseph to check on the brothers who were shepherds and tending the sheep. And when he makes his way to Shechem keeps coming up. They're not there. And some of the people see Joseph looking around, you know, and what are you looking for? And he described his brothers, and somebody said, well, I saw them, heard them talking. They said they were going to go on up to Dothan. And this is Tel Dothan. And so he made his way up to Dothan, and from a long distance they saw him coming. Tel Dothan, by the way, is on the Via Maris, the international road that connects Egypt to Mesopotamia, which is why the caravan was passing right through Dothan. That's the way they went. And it turns out, of course, this is where the brothers maliciously sell Joseph and then deceive their aged father by letting him draw the obvious conclusion when they held Joseph's bloody coat of many colors. Do you recognize this? And of course it was his. They knew what he would think. And so he mourned for his son. Meanwhile, Joseph was very much alive. And God exalted him all the way up to being next to Pharaoh himself. And he was doing this to prepare for a place for Israel to develop into a great nation. And that's exactly what took place. There's a passage that for some time I'd not really noticed that much. It's in Genesis 46 and verse 3. And that is where God appeared to Jacob at Beersheba, and he said, fear not to go down into Egypt, for I will there make of you a great nation. I'd not paid too much attention to that word there before. But Israel would be made a great nation, not in Canaan, but in Egypt. And then in verse 4, he says, and I will bring you back again. And so that's what happened. After that second trip, Joseph had revealed himself to his brothers and sent wagons. And so in obedience to God's command in Genesis 46, they left Beersheba, 70 souls, and they made their way onto the land that would be the land of Goshen, where they would have that area to grow and work and develop. You know, you stop and think about it. If God had not taken that measure, it had already been seen. For example, the men of Shechem were very willing to intermarry with the Israelites. Judah married a Canaanite. And so the Canaanites would have been very willing to do that, and Israel, if they had done that, would have just been absorbed into Canaanitish culture. They wouldn't have been a separate people. But in Egypt, it was an abomination for an Egyptian to eat with a Hebrew. And so they would have their own place, and they would grow up to be a separate people. And so God took those measures. And as time went on, they were, as I mentioned a while ago, reduced to a slave people. And they were involved in the work of making bricks. This 15th century B.C. a painting is from a nobleman's tomb, and it's showing the work of brick making. And God had told Abraham in Genesis 15 that your seed will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them. And this is before Isaac was even born. And he says, they will afflict them 400 years, And also that nation whom they serve will I judge, and afterward they will come out with great substance. And so they were involved in the work of making bricks for storage cities, mixing brick with straw, drying it in the sun. I don't know, can you see there in various places the straw? These are some bricks I photographed in Egypt that do show even today they still use that same practice. Well, I said they're a slave people, and this brings us to the time that Moses was born. And Moses was strategically placed by his mother in the reeds among the Nile River. Now, I was reading a preacher's discussion, which is a fine thing to do. I do wish sometimes people would take the time to be more careful with the text. But some were talking about Moses being put in the basket and floating down the Nile River, and how this was similar to one of the Assyrian legends and that sort of thing. He's not floating anywhere down the Nile River. He's stationary. He's put among the reeds. And so, for example, if you look closely here along the banks of the Nile River, there would be places, where you could put him, where he's in the Nile and among the reeds, but not out there floating in the Nile. Well, of course, this is where Pharaoh's daughter opened the basket, and the baby cried, and she had compassion on him, and she even gave him his name Moses, Moshe, which means to draw out of the water. And so he grew up 40 years and received a wonderful education. He was mighty in word and deed, but at the age of 40, he went to visit his brethren, because, you see, he was raised by his own mother. Pharaoh's daughter, as Miriam, the sister of Moses, said, "You want me to get a nurse for you?" And so Moses' mother was procured for that. And so he knew he was a Hebrew. And at the age of 40, he made his way to visit his brethren, and trying to defend a Hebrew, he killed an Egyptian. The next day, he was trying to straighten out a couple of Israelites that were fighting among themselves, and one of them said, it says the one who did wrong, he's the one that was in the wrong. He said, "Who made you a ruler or judge over us? You're going to kill me like you did the Egyptian?" And so when that thing was known, Moses had to flee because they would be seeking his life. And so what he did was to make his way down to the foothills of Mount Sinai. And it was here that he married Zipporah and had children, and for the next 40 years would be tending sheep as a shepherd. One day, he was out doing just that, and he saw a shrub, a bush, just like this in the Sinai desert, except it was on fire. And it was just all by itself, and it was on fire, and it did not burn out. And he said, "I'll see this strange sight." And he made his way over there, and then the voice spoke, "Take your shoes off, you're on holy ground." And so this was not just any fire. This is theophanic fire. This is a divine appearance. And so the speaker is referred to as the Malach Adonai, the angel of the Lord. And yet, as you continue to read the narrative, that is dropped, and it simply says the Lord back and forth as he talks with Moses and tells him to go to Pharaoh and tell him to let God's people go. Well, of course, Pharaoh wasn't going to do that, and God said that he wouldn't. But you have the 10 plagues that took place, and then Pharaoh let them go. It's interesting. I know some of you are taking notes. Let me give you a couple of verses. In Exodus 6 and verse 6, and in chapter 12 and verse 12, these are passages. The first, they serve as bookends for the 10 plagues. But they both make the point that God is saying, "Against the gods of Egypt will I execute judgments in the land." And so these weren't just plagues, but Egypt deified the Nile River. God turned it to blood. And you can just go right down the line. They worshiped Ra, the sun god, and he made it dark. They worshiped they deified the frog, and boy, did they get lots of frogs. And you can just go on right through all those plagues, and God is showing that these gods are nothing and that he is the true God. And so at some point there in the Red Sea, Moses and Israel crossed the Red Sea. The Egyptians tried to follow them. God made the wall of the water a wall on either side. They crossed. And then when the Egyptians tried to do so, the water came back together and all the Egyptians were drowned. Some years ago, I've been a couple of times to Egypt and to photograph the Red Sea from both sides, as best we can tell, near the area of the crossing, general area. But I have to tell you that my first time to do this was in 2003, and we crossed the Red Sea, my daughter and I, going under a tunnel to get to the other side. And I'd already told my local guide I wanted to take photos looking back at Egypt and how the water would have been just like this. And we got out there to a place that we could pull off and take photos. And there's a guy with a machine gun that says, "You can't take photos here." And I said, "You don't understand. I've got to take photos here. That's what I came for." And, of course, he has the machine gun, and I'm sweating bullets at the time myself. But anyway, after we had talked a while, he said, "Okay, point your camera that way and that way, but not this way. There's a military installation dead ahead." So anyway, you're sitting in a pew all comfortable and looking at these photos. I'll tell you, I didn't know if I was going to get shot or not when I was taking them. But I can certainly relive that. But this is what it would have looked like as Israel is safely across the Red Sea, and now the waters are back together. So they continue to journey. They make their way a 3 days journey without water. And then they get to a place that they will name Marah. And the reason they call it that is because there's water there, but it's bitter. They cannot drink it. And God miraculously made it drinkable. Marah has been identified, and that's what this is here. Anytime you see greenery like that in a desert location, there's water there, and this is one of the wells there at Marah. So this seems to be the area that took place. Well, we continue to travel, and the text narrates the journey to Elim, and it talks about the 70 palm trees and the 12 springs of water. And again, I used to wonder, why would you do that? Why would you tell us how many palm trees and springs there were? But if you've been marching in that sand, in that heat for that long, and then you get to a place that's an oasis, you'd count them every one. That was really noteworthy, and so they did that. I'll tell you, that sand is hot. That song, "Way Down in Egypt, Mid Burning Sand." I wanted to get some water from the Red Sea, so I took my shoes off and waded out a little bit and then walked back to our van and kind of washing the sand off. I'll tell you, that sand was so hot, it burned the skin off the bottom of my feet. It was hot. And so, again, little things like that helped me to see how accurate the Bible is. They're counting those palm trees and those wells, because it was so refreshing to see that after what they'd been through. But see, you can look away from Elim, and it's just desert, and it's just dry everywhere, but God is providing for them at that point. Well, we make our way to Mount Sinai. This satellite photo is instructive, because here you can just see everything. You can see Mount Sinai, you can see the Gulf of Aqaba, and you can see the Gulf of Suez. And in fact, on up, you can see where Israel is up here. And so that gives us a good perspective, though, of Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai is going to be very important. It's going to be here that Israel would stay for about a year. In chapter 19, they arrive in the third month of the first year. In Numbers chapter 10 and verse 10, it's going to be the second month, the 20th day of the month of the second year when they move. So they arrive in the first year, third month. They will head out in the second year, second month. So they're there about 11 months. And there is a water supply, which you have to have that, an area that's suitable for camping, you have to have that. And it's here we have three things, and then we'll close out our lesson for tonight. One thing that's very important: up until now, revelation had been oral. God had revealed himself from the beginning, orally. God spoke to the fathers in divers ways. And yet with Moses, we usher in a new and a very epic time when the law is in written form. And so the two tablets of stone and the other laws and ordinances that were based upon that, and the people said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. They entered into covenant relationship with the Lord here. Sacrifices were offered and blood was sprinkled on the covenant and on the people. So that's one very important thing, God giving his covenant and the people entering into that covenant with him at Mount Sinai. Second thing is, the tabernacle was built. And here again, this was labor intensive. There was a time that is involved to do that. This, by the way, is in southern Israel. It's very near the tip of Aqaba that I was just showing you a while ago. This place is called Timnah. And they have put together here in the desert a tabernacle that's built to scale. It's quite fascinating to see that and to walk around, walk inside it and photograph that. So the tabernacle is built, and it was meant to be portable, and this was the central place of worship. And the third thing and final thing is the priesthood was established. Aaron and his sons were given the priesthood. And all of that takes place over that 11-month period, and then we continue and take up, the Lord willing, tomorrow evening. We continue with the from Sinai, the wilderness, wanderings, and all the way through the United Kingdom. That'll be our lesson for tomorrow night. Well, you've listened well, and I appreciate that very much. And as I say, Linda and I are just so glad to be here. I need to ask you, though, there might be some here that one or more that needs to obey the gospel. A song has been selected, and if you know what you need to do, and you are willing tonight to obey from the heart the gospel of Christ, there are brethren here that would be happy to assist you. And if you have strayed from the Lord and need to renew your covenant with him, we encourage that as well, as together we stand and sing.
Come to Jesus, he will save.